Brian Madden. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, 2006, and you're listening to Brian Madden Live. As you know, Brian Forum Europe 2006 ended a few weeks ago. I spent quite a bit of time over the course of the 3 days recording conversations with several presenters. We'll be releasing each of these as a podcast over the next several days. Guests include names that are familiar to you, like Ron Oglesby, Kevin Goodman, and Rick Mack, as well as some new names like Jason Conger and Michelle Rhodes. Today's show is the first in the Brian Forum Europe 2006 series. It's a conversation with Rick Mack about what it takes to get those tricky applications working in terminal server environments. Brian Forum Europe 2006,
yep.
End of day two, and we're at the dinner. And I pulled aside Rick Mack, who has flown here all the way from Australia. So Rick, certainly thanks for taking the time to sit down with me tonight.
That's okay. Anything to get a seat.
Yeah, and you must be pretty tired with the jet lag and all that kind of stuff. But
another day or two, I'll be fine.
Great, just in time for it to end.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, this is your third Bri Forum.
Yep.
Where you presented, and the topics you have always presented on, well, first of all, I should say, probably most people listening know this, that your sessions have been among the most popular, most highest rated at all the Bri Forums. And for those who are not familiar with, Rick's sessions are about, how should we say, making bad applications less bad by doing all sorts of things, poking into the OS and the way the applications work and tuning and tweaking and all this kind of stuff. So I guess I want to say, first of all, I'm curious. See, most of us, when we run into a bad application, we kind of throw our hands up and walk away and say, well, it's not compatible. But not you.
Oh, I'm too stupid to give up. I don't know. Maybe it's the challenge or the chase or whatever. But if I'm going to be beaten, at least I want to know why I've been beaten. I think probably the important thing to say is there are very few applications that won't run on terminal services, provided you can find out why they won't work the way you want them to. And essentially, once you know your enemy, you're halfway there, or more than halfway there, because you can start putting strategies together to fix it. And I guess probably where my talks have kind of evolved from pure application debugging to trying to present at least part of a process that you should follow to determine what's happening. And I guess the other thing that's happened over the last 18 months or so is, partially as a result of my Bri Forum activities, I've become a lot more curious about what else is out there. I've discovered some things that, gee, I wish I'd known about them 3 or 4 years ago, because it would have made life heaps easier. And I guess, really, that's one of the things that's changed a little bit, the type of presentation I'm giving, because I guess if I'd leave people with no other message, it's that life isn't really that difficult. And if you use the right tools, 95% of the things you threw your hands up in the air at and were ready to walk away from really aren't such a big deal. And interestingly enough, a lot of the really useful stuff is actually available from Microsoft. Microsoft have been aware of application issues, not just on terminal services, but on Windows for quite a while. And they've slowly been dealing with that. And the interesting thing from my viewpoint is it's one of the very few areas where they really haven't done very much advertising, if you like, of the tools that are available. And it's really only just now that they're looking at trying to convince their user base to take the big step up to Vista that this stuff is coming out of the woodwork. And we're actually realizing they've got all these neat tools they put together to make the porting job from XP to Vista, which is a very much more secure environment, both feasible and relatively painless for people. Because I guess in a very real sense, unless they achieve that, people are just going to stick with what they know. And it just happens the secure environment that we're looking at with Vista really reflects in a lot of ways the environment that we've tried to have in terminal services. The concept of a limited user account where users don't have local administrator rights, where they don't have access to everything, where applications install in a very compartmentalized way and they don't drop DLLs in the system area and all that sort of stuff. And if we have a look at what Microsoft have done recently, that just as a prelude to my actually saying something real, there's a company called Desktop Standard which has developed some brilliant group policy extensions that let you do things in group policy that you couldn't do previously. Microsoft has acquired them. We've got SoftGrid, which basically got around many of the issues that people have got with getting applications going in a secure environment. Microsoft bought them. And so Microsoft are busy acquiring all the technology they need to host applications in a secure environment and, in fact, to manage them and manage something more than just Microsoft applications. Anyway, I guess back to...
I would say, so moving forward, it sounds like that there's good things in store as far as Microsoft and their approach to applications and how we can do things with them. But getting back to where we are today...
Oh, where we are today, we've still got a lot of problem applications, and interestingly enough, even some brand new ones that have still got problems. So all the stuff that Microsoft have been saying for the last 4 or 5 years, in terms of how you should write applications, how you should install applications, how you should package and that sort of thing, are still being largely ignored. And unless you buy, you have the luxury of buying an application which says certified for Windows and not Windows 95, I think we're going to continue to have application issues, so we really have to put strategies in place to deal with them.
So understanding that, of course, in your presentations, you go into the details of the tools and some techniques that you can use for kind of dealing with these bad applications, and that's obviously not stuff that sort of translates well to an audio conversation, but maybe kind of from a high level, walk through the process. I mean, I guess, first of all, you said that identifying the, you know, exactly what's happening is half the problem, or half the solution, I guess. But let's even back up. What types of things? I mean, I guess people are used to applications like, what, only one instance is running at a time, or it just won't run in terminal server, or it requires administrative rights, or
yep.
Things like this.
Okay, we used to do things the hard way, and used to do things the hard way, that sounds pretty trite. The sad part is that one of the chief tools that we ought to be using for terminal services is actually the Microsoft Application Compatibility Toolkit. It's got two parts. The first part is largely two parts. The first part is the application verifier. And this is actually a tool which you can run against an application to identify a whole lot of bad behavior that the application's got. And the nice thing about it is you can run it as an administrator, and that will actually tell you whether that application is trying to write to the machine registry, is trying to write to system area program files, that sort of thing. It identifies a lot of issues that we used to, you know, have to identify post-installation, if you like, with tools from sysinternals like the anti-file system monitor, anti-registry monitor, etc. So life has actually got a heck of a lot easier.
And this application compatibility toolkit, you said that's from Microsoft?
That's from Microsoft. There have been many versions of it out, and it's interesting the way it's actually evolved. It's evolved from a tool for developers to identify application issues to... Once version 5 of the application compatibility toolkit kit comes out, it's in beta at the moment, it's basically being developed for Vista. It's got an information gathering agent, which basically you can push out into your existing workstation environment, for example, and it will identify all the application issues, LUA issues, limited user account issues, file sharing issues, and that sort of thing that the applications have, old APIs. The agent gathers that data, pushes it back to a central SQL database, and then they actually have an analysis engine which looks at that data and can actually automatically push out application compatibility fixes for those applications. So you can basically, with XP, you can roll this stuff out into your XP fleet, get all this information back, apply the compatibility fixes, so those applications are basically wrapped up, ready to go onto Vista. But the big problem with that is that the developer tools part of the application compatibility toolkit, if you like, have disappeared. So that's basically why I've got version 2.5 of the application verifier downloadable from Bryforum site. It's probably the easiest to use version of the application verifier. The logs come out in a human readable form. They're not XML logs and all that sort of thing. I mean, XML is great, but I'm not real good at looking at an XML log and pulling sense out of it. The version 4 application compatibility toolkit has got probably the very best version of the compatibility administrator. And it does brilliant things like when you're doing the LUA registry fix, for example, is tunes itself. So once you've got the fix ready to install, the compat admin actually has you run the application. It has a look at which registry keys that application is touching, and it redirects them only. So it's a very efficient process, and indeed much more efficient than AIE or SoftGrid from that viewpoint. But I guess once we've dealt with LUA issues and all that sort of thing, we still get applications where we've got to get a bit dirty with them and actually find out what the heck they're doing. This is particularly true when you've got performance problems, because performance problems can be due to any number of things, which include applications hitting any files at 20 times a second just in the background because some programmers actually had the any file lookup not inside the initialization part of the program but in fact inside the main loop, and things like applications that really try to do some pretty stupid things. And in that sort of scenario, you'll occasionally hit the wall from the viewpoint that you'll have to lift your level of expertise quite a bit higher to identify what the application's doing. But like I said, 95% of the time, it's not that hard to firstly identify what your problem is and actually deal with it. And I guess I mentioned the file system monitor, the registry monitor. The other side of that, because of course much of what we do in a network scenario is grabbing files off the network, etc., is to use Wireshark, it used to be Ethereal, to actually look at SMB traffic. So what you basically do is to set your ports to port 137, 138, 139, and 445, and that way you're looking at all the network file system traffic in and out of a server, and you can have a look at what an application's doing on the network.
So what are you kind of looking for if you're taking a look at that?
I guess if it's a performance issue, you're looking for... you get two types of performance issues. The first one is due to the fact that the application's hammering the network because it's doing something really stupid. And an absolutely delightful example of that was CorelDRAW 9, which had a 14K CorelDRAW any file, and when you put that file on a network share, something terrible happened insofar as CorelDRAW was actually reading that file one byte at a time. So in reading in a 14K file, what we were doing was actually generating 14,000 separate network IO requests, and of course your minimum packet size is 64 bytes. So with what seems like a very simple operation, because somebody wasn't using the appropriate Windows APIs, i.e. legacy code, that application just absolutely killed back-end servers. Applications reading any files is actually a lovely way to kill a network. The other sorts of issues you see are timeout issues. This is where using the various tools with timestamping turned on is so terribly important, because what you're actually looking at is periods of time when nothing is happening. That probably means the application just sitting there waiting. As far as you're concerned, it's going slow as a dog. But
in reality, it's not doing anything.
In reality, it's not doing anything. It's waiting for something. And there, in particular, you're looking for holds, if you like, that are 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds. Because when you hit that, you're almost always dealing with some sort of operating system timeout value or whatever. Once you know you're dealing with that, you can start channeling your efforts in the right direction. I guess the process starts off with just information gathering. You're looking for a needle in a haystack sometimes, and you just got to look at everything and until you start getting ideas about pointing yourself in the right direction. It sounds pretty awful, but I mean, where you've got, you really only have to put that sort of effort in probably in 5 to 10% of the applications that aren't working properly. The bulk of the things are either are generally LUA issues, file sharing issues and stuff like that, which nowadays you can deal with quite nicely with the compatibility administrator.
And so you talked about that compatibility kit, and there's a compatibility administrator was the first part of that kit.
Yeah.
And then it's, so what's the second part?
For me, probably the first part's the application verifier.
Oh, okay, right, right.
The reason for that is that if you're setting up a new terminal server environment, you know, you just had a customer who, for whatever reason, decided, okay, we're going Citrix, we're going terminal services. Most times, at least in the projects I've been involved in the past and people I've talked to, they build a terminal services environment and then they have this porting process. I call it a porting process where you basically install the applications on terminal services, run them as administrator, run them as two users, run them as a...
It's kind of try more and more each time and sort of see if and where they finally break.
Yeah, and that process can actually be quite time-consuming. You know, you either get overly generous in allocating time for that process, or you blow your project time out of the water, or you get smart. And getting smart really means identifying the bulk of your problems before you actually put those applications on the terminal services. And that's really where the application verifier is a superb tool. You know, if you can identify all of your bad applications and actually solve the problems with 95% of them up front, that's going to make the likely success of the project and the ease with which you can actually do it hugely easier. Getting back on course a little bit, I guess in addition to dealing with applications that don't work properly on terminal services, the other issue we've got in terminal services, because it's a multi-user environment, is there's behavior in standard applications that we want to be able to change. A very effective way to do it nowadays is, of course, with a product like the AppSense Application Manager, where you can basically say, I don't want that menu to work, I don't want that option to work, etc. In Microsoft applications, and indeed in almost all Windows applications, with Office, we've got the disable items group policy. With a lot of other applications, we've actually got the ability to edit the resources part of the application, which is basically all the menus, all the buttons, all the strings, and that sort of thing. As an example, Tim was giving a very good talk this afternoon where Tim Mangan, where one of the things he used to basically cripple the system was calculator doing factorials. And he turned around to me and said, yeah, I'm sure you could do something with that. And I'd never tried with calculator. And in fact, you can get rid of the factorial button if you want to.
Right. So, and you're talking about, this is the sort of the classic example, like ResHacker or something like that, right?
Oh, yeah. ResHacker is a brilliant tool for that.
You basically open up the executable itself and you see all the buttons and you can go in there and just... say you can kind of change the Windows button state, right, to say that, like, I want the factorial to be grayed out. And I think probably what most people might remember is Jim Kenzig used to publish what he called a gray PN, which is a grayed out version of the program neighborhood software, where he just removed the settings menu from the or the settings option from the menu, so it just didn't work. So
it's so terribly easy to do. The only difficult part sometimes is the resources part of an executable isn't necessarily an executable. In fact, most of the larger Microsoft applications like Internet Explorer, Outlook, etc., they've actually got a resources DLL where everything's in that particular DLL. So all the internationalization, language, menus, everything is in there. So then you've got a little bit of a chase to find out which DLL's actually got the bits you want in it. And that's where utilities like sysinternal strings utility, for example, which lets you look at ASCII strings or Unicode strings inside an executable or DLL handy.
I have no clue what a string is, so...
Oh, sorry. Well, a string is simply a human-readable set of letters.
Oh, so you mean like a string, like a program, like, so a string, you mean like you can look in there and see what DLLs it's looking for?
What actual text is in there. Sorry, I should have said text instead of strings.
Oh, okay, right.
So if I know what text is in the menu that I want to disable, then basically what I do is look for that text in the DLLs.
You basically Google the DLL folder, right, to find the, text that you're looking for.
So it's really, again, just building up a strategy to deal with this stuff. And the nice thing is you can turn off anything. The challenge afterwards is if it's a systems component, shoehorning that systems component back in without getting Windows file protection, etc., killing you. But we've actually found that the Windows 2000 hotfix mechanism.
Well, back up for a second. So what you're talking about specifically, I guess, is when you're editing these resources, you're basically changing the file, right? So
correct.
The idea is if you have a file you need to change and you use a resource hacker or what have you to change it, that's cool. But as soon as Windows sees that file's changed, the Windows file protection kicks in and
replaces
back
it.
To it the original version. Okay.
Yeah, so how do we deal with that? And one way that people have dealt with it is to turn off Windows file protection.
Well, that's like making every application run as administrator and all these simple fixes, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty dumb way to do it. Putting the change in as a hotfix has got the major advantage that it's documented. That is, you actually see that hotfix and add remove programs. And if you've screwed up, you can actually reverse out of it. So that gives you two things. It gives you reversibility and accountability for handling that sort of thing. We've actually had to descend occasionally to actual binary edit of an executable, but that's pretty damn rare. It's like using a Windows debugger for applications. When you've got to get to the point where you've got to do stack traces and all that sort of thing to find out what the application's doing, you're probably getting out of your depth. And, you know, you're in a lot deeper water than you should be. At that point, you've got to make a decision as to whether you throw your hands up in the air and make it somebody else's problem or get something like SoftGrid and just wrap it up in a bubble so you can forget about it.
Well, let's back up for a second. The hotfix thing is interesting.
Yeah.
So you said, you know, just make it a hotfix, and that way you can, you know, deploy automatically. So I guess what you're saying is, we've found the application we want to change or the component or what have you.
Yep.
We edit the file, which basically means we're changing the, you know, changing the actual file itself. And then you say kind of, you know, if we roll it into our own hotfix, we make our own custom, you know, Brian version hotfix and roll out. I'm not familiar with making my own hotfixes, so.
Okay, well, it's dead simple because Windows 2000 hotfix mechanism consisted of basically two files. A hotfix.inf file, which described the actions that the hotfix was to take in terms of what files comprised the hotfix and where they were to be copied to, and hotfix.exe. So, in fact, all you do is you modify the file. Actually, that's one thing I should do, give you working hotfix inf and exe, because it's dead simple to modify a file that...
Basically, you just look at an existing hotfix.
Look at an existing hotfix. You've got to tailor the top and the bottom of the file to the service pack number, etc., of the OS that you're going to put that hotfix into, and the bottom of the file to put a proper hotfix name and everything. That is something that's identifiable to you.
And so if you have your own internal, you make your own naming scheme and all that stuff.
Yeah. I've got one customer. We've got literally dozens of hotfixes because they wanted Outlook modified. They actually wanted the Explorer.exe modified. They wanted the Gina modified because they wanted a slightly different security message when you logged in. It's turned out to be quite manageable as hotfixes, whereas if we were just dropping files into the file system, it'd be a bloody nightmare.
And I guess this is easy to deploy. I mean, you know, deploy via IM or SMS or whatever.
Oh, absolutely, because you're just running an executable.
And then it shows up in the list when you go to add remove programs. You see Brian's custom hotfix.
And if you remove it, it reverts back to the way it was. Let's see, what else have we got? Got the resource hacker. There are a whole bunch of tools you can start using to get a little bit more intimate with applications. And in fact, we used to look at the sysinternal tools and Marko Sinovic as, you know, the god of application debugging, which is still true to a large extent, even if he has sold out to Microsoft. Sorry, Mike.
Who can blame him?
Yeah, who can blame him? I mean, if somebody offered me a swag of money, I'd probably take it too.
Absolutely.
But there's a guy by the name of Russell Osterlund, who's got a bunch of utilities, PE Browser, PE Browser Pro, where he's got some really simple tools to really get deep and dirty into applications and find out what applications are doing. There's a lot of overlap with what the sysinternal tools do, but it does give you a very different look at things. I guess the other side of the coin, once you've got your applications going, by whatever way, is how you manage them, to manage the settings and that sort of thing. And that's really where tools like RegShot, which I think you've mentioned, Reg2ADM, which is part of a package called NUTS, N-U-T-S.
Reg2ADM, I guess, does probably what its name implies.
Yeah, you basically say for Acrobat Reader, you run up RegEdit, you go to HKEY Current User Software, Adobe, just export that key to a Reg file, you run up Reg2ADM, import the Reg file into it, and it will actually basically build you a skeleton policy template for Acrobat Reader.
So really, you can kind of do a 1-2 with RegShot. So the idea is if you have some application, you want to hopefully control via group policy, you fire up RegShot, take your pre-shots, make your change in the application, take your post-shot, find the register key, then register ADM, that builds your skeleton ADM template.
Yep.
And then you
delete everything you don't want, and then you've got a choice. I mean, you should never make a policy template that isn't reversible. Microsoft have two types of policies that you can apply. They have the concept of managed policies, and the idea of a managed policy is it's transient. That is, the effects are actually applied via, at a user level, HK current user software policies, Microsoft, etc., or software Windows current version policies. And if you disable those policies, they are no longer in effect. With policy that you hack up yourself, that is essentially an unmanaged policy, what happens is you're actually changing the registry permanently. Disabling that policy won't revert those changes. You've actually got to design your policy template so it's reversible. So with Acrobat Reader, if you've got an option to disable a splash screen, you should also put in an option to enable it. So you can go through, and if you've applied this particular policy, you can actually basically untick a bunch of things, and that policy will put things back the way they were.
I guess because otherwise, in this unmanageable way, you essentially rewrite that register key to zero on the workstation or the target, you know, terminal server or whatever, and you have no idea what it was before. So if you realize that's bad,
yeah,
you know.
Because, I mean, occasionally you might make a mistake, and if you don't design your group policy template to be reversible, you just painted yourself into a corner big time. Essentially, Reg2ADM gives you the skeleton, RegShot directs you to the bits of the skeleton you need, and then what you've got to do from that point is actually put enough extra intelligence into the policy template to reverse everything that you've turned on. There's a really nice tool for doing that. It's an Australian one, but that's okay. So is ResHacker, called the ADM Template Editor from a company called SysProSoft. And what it allows you to do is to now import your ADM file into the policy editor. It makes it very easy to make everything reversible, so you don't actually have to get in there and edit the ADM file with Notepad or something. Make sure that you've got proper syntax. Allows you to put in explanations for everything. So the stuff that adds a lot of extra work to putting together your own policy templates, in fact, gets really easy at that point. And you know absolutely that the end product from that editing process will work, and will work the way it's supposed to. That then gives you a very powerful way of managing things. The one frustrating thing with policy templates used to be that there were some types of registry values that you couldn't deal with. Binary strings, multi-string expressions, and that sort of thing. And Desktop Standard basically released their registry extensions tool into the public domain. It's freeware, which allows you to import a binary string from one machine into the group policy to push it out everywhere else. So all the toolbars and stuff like that we used to have to go to some real pain to change are now dead easy. As I said earlier, the product's good enough that Microsoft bought them. So we can expect great things from Microsoft, I guess. And you'll finally be able to use group policies to manage things properly.
So if someone is listening to this, and there's a lot of tools and a lot of specific situations, I guess, you know, for someone to kind of get started in this area, I guess you have to start with the bad application as your target application and just kind of go through the steps that you're talking about.
If I had nothing else, if I could give you basic advice and really make it very simple, then I'd say start with the application compatibility toolkit, because if you can solve 95% of your problems easily and you've got a tool which actually will identify all that stuff without having to scan you know, registry logs and file system access logs and all that sort of thing, why not? If you're curious and you want to find out exactly what's happening and that sort of thing, then that's the time to start looking at all the other tools. ResHacker is probably a special case because it gives you such a powerful tool for changing sociability aspects of applications.
You can be a UI designer now, right?
Oh, look, it's been great. I mean, I've used it for things like, trivial things like, you know, putting customers' logos into the logon genome.
Well, I'd imagine April Fool's Day has a lot of potential for ResHacker.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things we did for one customer was they wanted a crippled Internet Explorer. And the problem is with the IE admin kit, you can only go so far in terms of what you can cripple. But with ResHacker, you can remove anything. And the thing is, you drop that crippled DLL onto a workstation, there's no way around it. So, it would be a glorious way to make life difficult for some people.
The functionality is just actually being removed from the, yeah, the resource files. So it's not a policy thing. It's not a security thing. It's that menu
doesn't exist anymore.
It's
gone, yeah. And same thing with hotkeys and all that sort of thing. So you've got total control, ultimately, over what you can do inside an application.
Well, always a pleasure to spend time with you, Rick. And I'm certainly glad you're taking the time out of your schedule tonight, and appreciate again you making the plane ride all the way over here from Australia.
Oh, it's always good fun.
Today's show was copyright 2006 by the Brian Madden Company. Thanks for listening.